hear me okay? Okay, great. All right, if I happen to slip away from the microphone, just please let me know, and I'll throw something at me, whatever, and I'll get back closer again. So, wow, what a great privilege to be here with all of you. And as was mentioned, I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm from Western Massachusetts. I live in a small city called Westfield, Massachusetts. Some of you at this little short period of time that I've been speaking might have realized that it don't sound like I'm from Massachusetts. That's because I'm from the good side of Massachusetts anyway. So, just kidding. Anyway, no. We love our Boston friends in our Eastern Mass area for sure. And we cooperate with them planning a state convention, and we have Unity and Alcoholics Anonymous there. But we do have separate areas, and I was born and raised there. So I'm just grateful to be here. I was born and raised in Westfield, Massachusetts, and a proud member of the Holyoke Group, which meets on Thursdays and Sundays. We celebrated 67 years of continuous meetings, one of the oldest meetings in our area, this past May. So, and that group is meant a lot to me. In any event, I'm here to celebrate. I was here to participate at the at your Aries Assembly today, and I've been here since Thursday, I guess I got here. Boy, the time's gone by fast. And it's bittersweet. I want to go home to see my family, but I want to stay and be with my new family here anyway, too. But grateful to be here with all of you. As it says in How It Works, our stories disclose in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And that's how my sponsor taught me how to share. And to me, that equates to experience, strength, and hope. And I hope that I can convey that today when tonight when I share my story with you. From my earliest memories, I had alcoholic behavior and thinking before I ever picked up a drink. From my earliest memory, I never had any security, inner security whatsoever. It wasn't that I was insecure. I had just had no security at all. I had no self-worth, no value of anything of myself ever. And from an early age, I began to define myself with things outside, and because I was afraid that people wouldn't like me. And that started in athletics with me. I was a hockey fanatic from my earliest memories. I was on skates when I was two. I was playing hockey by the time I was five formally, and I played that sport with everything that I had for a number of years growing up, and I played just about any other sport that I could get involved in, and that's how I defined myself. Yeah, my name's Bob, and I play hockey, you know. My name's Bob, and I play baseball, and so, in any event, I come from an alcoholic home as well, and that's not why I'm an alcoholic, but it definitely has a lot to do with my story. It's a big part of my story. My mother was an alcoholic. My father is an alcoolic. I had alcoholic grandparents all over my family. And when I was a little boy, my earliest memories of being maybe 5 years old, 6 years old, and coming home from kindergarten and not being able to find my mother in particular, that really scared me. And I'd have to go find the neighbor to find her. My mother would be passed out in the basement, and then she'd be thrown up later in the toilet, and I didn't know what was going on, you know. And that went on for my life until I was about 9 years old. When the miracle day came to our household and my mother found Alcoholics Anonymous, and what a miracle that was. My father, I never saw a whole lot of his drinking. He drank a lot when I was sleeping at night. He was a salesman. But I do have a recollection of my father running up and down the street in a Tarzan costume, pounding his chest. And it wasn't Halloween. What are you doing, Dad? That's cool. Where'd you get that? In any event, my mom found AA, and I started going to meetings right away with my mom. And I was one of these these little kids that you see running up and down the aisles of AA meetings causing a ruckus and making trouble. And later on here, I got sober in AA, and I was one of these young people running up and down the aisles making trouble. But in any event, I was so happy when my mother got sober and our family was really assembled for the first time, and we had a lot of love in our home. And my father got sober when I was 11, a few years later, and it was a great thing. So then I went to meetings with both of them. I went to meetings all the time. And our phone rang off the hook, and people came to our house and stayed in the basement, and my mother would stay up talking to people all night long and get on the hotline, and she was involved in service and chaired roundups and meetings and spoke at meetings and did all these kinds of things, and my father followed suit, and it was just, it was a good life. But you know, the day came for me. I didn't mean for this to happen. I know from my earliest memories that I never wanted to become like my mother or my father, but particularly my mother. I swore that I would never do that. I have an older brother and an older sister, and when I was 13, my sister was in college, and she came home for a weekend with her girlfriends, my parents were out at the Wilbraham Friday night meeting, so my sister thought, what better time to throw a party than when mom and dad are out at an AA meeting? And I just happened to be an innocent bystander being there at home. And so the party began, and that was the first and the last time that I ever drank Southern Comfort. I puked, I peed my pants, I passed out, and boy did I love it, you know. Whew! And you know, I share this a lot when I speak, the feeling that I had, and it's amazing how I can remember that long ago. You know, I'm 45 years old now, and I was 13 years old then, and I remember that night, that moment when that happened. And up to that point, that insecure young boy, who I was full of anxiety always, fear, this feeling of being a square peg trying to fit in a round hole. These are all feelings of, like, retrospect, you know, in hindsight being 2020. I didn't totally identify it then, but I see it so clearly now. And when I took that drink, as gross as it was, but that feeling that came from it, it was just like, oh, I can just be free, you know? And I have another vague recollection of trying to make out with a 23-year-old girl. Waking up with a sore nose because she pushed me away and said, get away from me, call me in 10 years. Which incidentally was the year I got sober in AA. She wouldn't have been good for me, for sure. And anyway, any event, I was petrified when I woke up that next day. Because of all the meetings that I had attended at that point in the last 3 or 4 years, since my mother had been coming to AA, my father had been coming to AA, I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew I loved it way too much. I loved the feeling way too much, and I was petrified. And I did not want to be an alcoholic. And that fear kept me away from alcohol until I was 17 years old. And that's when my drinking career really began, at 17. But my alcoholic behavior continued, it mushroomed into all the things that where alcohol leads us and takes us. And I was doing things before I was even drinking. And specifically, you know, I started dating young and growing very dependent upon having another person to define me, and all these things that we deal with, that we become such dependent people as alcoholics. So I started dating this girl when I was 13 years old, around the first time I picked up that drink. And you know, I never liked her. And so I dated her for 4 years, anyway. What a brutal battle. Oh my God. Oh, I'm like, twitchy. Oh man. And you know, I stayed with her, and I suffered because of all of this insecurity that I had, and this selfishness and self-centeredness, because I was so petrified that the entire city of Westfield, where I lived, the city of 40,000 people, if I broke up with her, would know that I did that and say, look what that boy did to that poor girl. And I literally was really afraid of that. So I stayed in that relationship, and I suffered. Oh my gosh. And I attended a Catholic school for 12 years, elementary all the way through high school. And I was never good in school. And as the time continued in school and as school became more difficult, I was extremely focused on athletics through that time, and I was okay with that. But all these things that were evolving and getting worse, this relationship in school and my relationship started to deteriorate with my parents even. An attitude of I didn't care just started to really grow within me, and my defiance really started being fueled, and I was just getting really ready to go to drink. And so that's what happened to me, and I was just ready, and I had given up, and I didn't care that I was an alcoholic anymore, and I was asked to split a six-pack with a boss of mine that was 10 years older than me when I was 17 years old, and I drank four beers to his two in a matter of whatever, 30 minutes or whatever it was, and I was off and running. And literally from that day, for the 6 years that I drank until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I drank as much as I could, whenever I could. And you know, that's hard to do when you're young and you live at home and you can't buy alcohol in the store and all that kind of thing. But I manipulated and found ways to do that. Around the time I was graduating from high school, thank God that girl cheated on me. I had a good reason to break up with her, so it could be her fault, and the whole city of Westfield could feel bad for me now. So a previous speaker mentioned the word victim. Yeah, that was good for me, you know. And in any event, I graduated from high school. I got out by the skin of my teeth, and my mother at that time had been in AA for 8 or 9 years or so. And my mother started to have some trouble within Alcoholics Anonymous in reconciling some of her outside religious views with the spirituality of Alcoholics Anonymous. And most of you know that Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual program, not a religious program. And she just really started to change and have some difficulty with that and develop some obsessions even with religion. And so she decided to leave AA. And my father followed suit. My brother and sister were long gone from the house. I had been drinking about a year. I was a full-blown alcoholic at this point already. And so I decided to leave home. I couldn't live there with my parents anymore. So I just had total freedom. I had freedom from this girl. I had freedom from my house and my parents and all of that. My father, thank God, he really encouraged me to go to college. And didn't make any sense. I could barely get out of high school scholastically, but I did what he said, and I went to community college, and I'm glad that I did. But I was a mess, and my time to begin to manipulate life really began at that point at 18 years old. And I would manipulate and lie to professors because I was always late with papers. I would miss 8 o'clock exams and classes all the time. I would blow attendance records, and I would cry, do whatever it took to get out of that kind of trouble. I've mentioned often, I think my grandparents died about 52 times during the few years that I was at that community college. I just had every excuse in the book. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. One semester I'd be on academic probation. The next semester I'd find a way to make the dean's list and get out of trouble. And I was up and down and up and down. And I manipulated my way to find alcohol. I wasn't old enough to buy it, but I could work in a store that sold it. And so I found a way, I guess with some sales abilities back at that time, is what I do for a living now. And I got myself a job in a liquor store, and which was perfect for me. The pay was terrible, but the benefits were wonderful, really. I mean, I could get alcohol whenever I wanted. So, shortly after I enrolled in this community college, I had met a girl at another college that I was up drinking at one time, and I actually liked her. And she seemed to like me too, and this was good. It was like the first time I ever dated anybody that I really liked. And I was like, wow, what a concept, you know? And she was nice, and she was pretty, and we talked well, and we had a lot in common and all that. And she was like real proper and on a good path. She was smart, and she was on a solid 4-year plan for a degree in psychology and with hopes to get a master's degree, which she ultimately went on to do. And so we dated, and I began just heavier drinking. And I look back now, and I didn't even realize what I was doing, but I was hiding my drinking from so many people around me all the time, and I didn't even know it. I rarely drank in bars. I drank in my apartment late at night. I drank down by the river all the time with these animals I used to hang out with. They were men, but they were animals. Believe me, they were animals. And we would have big fires down there. Oh, my God. And we did that night after night after night. And I would get drunk in my apartment, and I would start calling people. I was a blackout drinker. I had no idea who I called. There was this guy. Maybe he was from out here. I don't know. I used to watch him on the TV at night. He had a white beard. His name was Dr. Scott, I think, or something. And he'd smoke a cigar, and I was probably the only one watching him anyway. And I would call his show, and I could see he's talking to me on the TV. And I'm like, cool, you know? And then the next thing you know, I'd get a phone bill from 1-900-LOVE, and I'd be like, oh, no, what the heck happened there? $1,100, you know? I only make 50 bucks a week, you know? I was a train wreck, and oh, my goodness. I don't know what that's about, honey. I'm sorry. I don't know. Somebody must have tapped into our phone line. But I was a wreck. So, anyway, I plugged away through life. And at 20 years old, I started to work in my family's business. My great-grandfather started a company in my local city in 1923. And I was the fourth generation in there. And they would put a tie around me. And I had long hair and an earring. They put a tie on me. And they would put my picture in the paper and tout me as this promising fourth generation in this sales service organization. And I couldn't even work. I couldn't get out of myself at all. And I would show up there and I would just walk in and go in the basement and hide from everybody and hide from life. And then I'd go work in the liquor store at night and take alcohol home with me and get drunk. So anyway, my girlfriend was graduating from high school. And I decided on her graduation day that I was going to propose to her. And so I did that, and she said yes, and that was great. And that was one more thing that really made things look good on the outside of my life. And now I was going to have a pretty wife, and I had all my kids figured out and all that sort of thing, and projected my whole life away. And so we went on in our engagement, and we were engaged for about a year, and that was the last year that I drank. And when I proposed to her and we got engaged, something clicked inside of my mind, and I remember those promises to never become like my mother. And I knew I had become just like my mother, and I couldn't stop drinking. I had passed a point of no return. I tried to stop all the time. I would wake up in the morning and I would swear off that I wasn't going to drink, and I could control this and I could stop this, and I knew I was an alcoholic. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, after the hangover would wear off, I would say, well, maybe I was a little hasty. And I would end up in the liquor store and bring home the beer, and I'd be drunk again, and I'd fall down the stairs or drive drunk like I did all the time, and wake up in my puke and all the great things that happened to us. And God only knows what else I did that I don't remember. So a few months before we were going to get married, we got back from a long weekend of wedding planning. We went to Vermont, and we had our guest list set. We were ready to send out our invitations, and she approached me, and she said, Bob, I want a separation from you. And I was completely floored at this moment. We really never had any friction in these 5 years that we were together. It seemed we really both wanted to be married, and I was just really scared. And I said, well, you're coming back, right? She said, yeah, I just want some time to think. I figured, jitters or whatever. And everybody gets that, right? And so a week later, she came back and gave me the ring back and told me that was it. She was gone. I realize now when I look back that my life was totally dependent upon her and alcohol, period. And that's it. In that last year that I drank, the alcohol just didn't work right for me anymore, you know? When I explained to you how I felt the first time I drank with that exhale and feeling that anxiety relief and that sort of stuff, That didn't happen for a while for me anymore, you know. When I think back to that, what alcohol did for me, I think it saved me sometimes when I look back, you know, through some of those tough years that I had and got me through, and it just didn't cut it for me anymore. And physically, it didn't do it either. I could drink for a whole day. I could drink a whole case of beer, and by the end of the night, I would be like, yes, officer, no problem, you know, standing on one foot and no big deal. And then another day I would drink a half a beer and I would pass out annihilated drunk. You know, I wouldn't even remember drinking a half a beer. My liver hurt all the time. I was always holding my side, and I was smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and I had filled up to just a big bloat of beer stuffing. And if you poked a pin in me, I'd start squirting beer out of my pores, and I was just loaded. I loved beer. I loved it. And so anyway, she was gone, and I was really left to be an empty shell of a man at that point in time. And I quit everything. I quit work. I quit school. I quit my friends, my family. I quit life. I literally was one of these people that drew the shades, and I just stayed in my dark apartment. I laid on the floor for about 3 weeks with a knife this long next to me, contemplating falling on that knife, and I immediately became suicidal, and I wanted to take my life. And that's where alcohol took me. And, you know, I had mentioned I called people a lot and wouldn't remember. And, you know, at this point in time in the state that I was in, I had become a regular with crisis intervention in my local town. I used to call them all the time, and I didn't even remember doing it. And evidently, that must have happened one night, because I heard a rap on the door, and I looked out the window, and there was a cruiser in the driveway, and I thought, uh-oh, I did it now. I knew I drove drunk all the time, and I thought I had hit somebody or had done something. So I opened the door, and there were two cops there, and they said, "We're coming to take you away." They had a little conversation with that person I spoke to last night on the phone, so I was like, I'm not going anywhere. Get out of here. I know my rights, and I kicked them out. And but those officers planted a seed. And that night, I was within inches of death, taking my life literally. What kept me from that, I don't know. I sometimes think my father finding me, maybe. So that night, I ended up checking myself into that a locked institution where those police officers were going to take me. And I'm so grateful for that. And I found gratitude in that facility, and I didn't even realize it. I believe today, after being in AA for 22 years, and gratitude is a true necessary ingredient for long-term sobriety. And I found gratitude in that locked mental institution. And I realized that there are people in this world that are worse off than me, you know. And incidentally, that's a great thing about AA. You can always find someone worse off than you. Look to your right, to your left, behind you. You don't have to tell them about it, though. Just keep it to yourself. But really, I found gratitude there. And I got out of there after a few weeks, and some old hockey buddies of mine took me out to a bar and for a rip-roaring drunk. And I remember being in the bar, and this is a real gray out for me. I remember part of this night and part not. And the bartender was a guy I played with, and I was crying into my beer bottle about my woes and my fiance leaving me, and I fished $8 and quarters into the jukebox and played the song "The End" by The Doors over and over again. I was very dramatic, I remember, as I can be now sometimes too. You know, the lampshade in us, right? We all have the lampshade hat, helmet, whatever. And so I was, "This is the end," you know, and my only friend is singing away, and two very large men picked me up and took me out of that bar, ripped the cord out of the jukebox, and, "You're a downer, man. Get out of here." So next thing I remember, I drove home drunk, I must have, and I was roaming around my apartment, And my father comes around the corner, and I'm like, what are you doing here? He's like, you called me, dummy. You know, I'm like, oh, oops, okay. So he starts arguing with me, and he's very worried about me at this point. He started arguing with me and saying, you know, you're a slob, you're ruining your life, you need to come back to work, get yourself together, man, and all this kind of thing. And I was arguing back, and I was drinking a beer, and I'll never forget, I had a half full beer, and in my midst of my argument, I slammed it down on the coffee table, and I said, fine, Dad, you want to hear me say it? My name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. And he looked at me, and he snickered a little bit, and he said, no kidding, I'm glad you finally realized it. And I was like, you so-and-so. And then I passed out. I don't remember much after that moment, but but I remember that, and it was important. And, you know, when that beer slammed down on March 30th, 1993, the last time that I drank, something happened to me. The desire to drink was removed from me. And I started coming to AA a few days later, and very early on, you know, somebody gave me a big book at my first meeting, and somehow or another I flipped to the spiritual appendix in the back of the big book. And it defines a spiritual experience in there as a personality shift sufficient enough to bring about recovery from alcoholism. Now, for a guy like me at that time, that was an awful lot for me to understand, you know, intellectually, but it spoke to my heart. And I had that displacement inside myself. And it was the most enormous gift that I ever could have received, and it exists to this day. And it has never the desire to drink has never returned to this day. In any event, I believe I really needed to take care of that gift. And as I mentioned, I started to go to Alcoholics Anonymous right away, and I've had a wonderful journey since I've been here. You know, it was tough in early sobriety when I first got here. I was kind of up and down. I would be, you know, on a pink cloud for a couple of days and really excited about sobriety. And then I would just hit the pits and just want my fiance to come back, you know. But I kept coming to meetings, and I went to as many meetings as I can, and I joined a group, and I got a sponsor, and I got active. I took suggestions. I did what he told me to do. At my second meeting, I was sitting in the back of a meeting, and I had a sponsor already, and the first thing he told me was, like, stay away from girls. Oh, how could you say such a thing? Blasphemy. And I was sitting in the back of a meeting, this beautiful girl walked up to the front of the room, and I was like, whoa. How am I going to do this? But I did, you know, and I took care of myself. I took care of me. And I learned how to love myself. And at a year sober, he took me through the steps. And my life drastically changed. I remember I did my fifth, sixth, and seventh step on a Saturday afternoon in a matter of 4.5 hours. And I was really rocketed into the fourth dimension when that happened to me, you know. And I've wanted to do nothing from that day to this but to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous as enthusiastically as I can. And that's really what I've tried to do. And at that time that I went through the steps, I started to get active in service. I put an institutions meeting on in that locked ward that I was in for 2 years. And I had to get 2 speakers every single week for 2 years. I had to go to a lot of meetings to get 2 speakers. They say people don't say no in AA. Go ahead and try that, you know. Especially when they find out where they're going to speak. Oh, I'm washing my hair. I can't make it. You know, I'm sorry. I got another meeting. I'm speaking somewhere else. And I became an alternate GSR and general service representative for my group, and I jumped into AA with both feet. And my life profoundly changed, and things really started to happen for me, and I started to try things, and I got really heavily involved back into my family's business, and ultimately I ended up buying that business from my family, and I still run and own that business today, which gives me the flexibility to be here with you at this particular time and to still continue to serve Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, a little while after I had gone through the steps, that girl that walked to the front of that room, I was like, I'm going to ask her on a date now. And I did. And she said no. Oh. I was thinking that Bob Seger song as I was sitting here. She was a black-haired beauty with big brown eyes, you know, and, you know, oh, man. So I was like, why? And she said, I have other plans. And I'm like, another time? She said, maybe. And so a couple weeks later, I asked her out again. She said, yes. And I was like, cool, you know. And so we started to date, and what ended up happening with us, we just had a wonderful courtship. We had a friendship, a courtship, and we really liked each other, and we went on these AA dates, and I love to equate it to The Godfather. It was like Michael and Apollonia Corleone. We'd go bowling, and there'd be like 16 old-timers behind us, like 15 feet. We'd be holding hands and, you know, Google-eyed, and they'd be like, you two be careful. We'd be like, we got it. Come on, you know. We're 25, you know. We can handle this. So so it was a beautiful experience, and, you know, we fell in love with each other here before anything else. You know, she's my best friend, and a few years following that, we got married, and we celebrated 18 years of marriage this past June. What a miracle, you know? Miracle, you know? We did not want to be boy meets girl on AA campus. You know, we talked about that. We interviewed each other. And, hey, what step you on? What do you think about this? Who's your sponsor? You know, all that kind of thing. And we've been blessed with six wonderful children through those years, too. And I have two boys. Some people think that's insane, but, you know, we have two boys, 16 and 14, and we have four girls, 13, 9, 7, and 4. Matthew, Joseph, Sarah, Rachel, Hannah, and Mary. And what a beautiful life it is. And Alcoholics Anonymous is at the center of our lives. My wife is still sober in AA, and I continue to serve on in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's sort of been my niche in AA. My wife has always been active in our group and sponsored women. And, you know, I went on to do many special services with Alcoholics Anonymous. I served as a district committee member and an area chair, and I was blessed to serve my area as its delegate in 2002 and 2003. And I was the youngest delegate at both of my conferences. They used to call me Young Bob all the time. And, you know, I rotated from that, and 10 years had gone by after I had rotated from being a delegate. And trusteeship had come up in our fellowship, and I made myself available for that. And ultimately, in 2013, I was elected to be what's called trustee at large for the United States. And so I represent Alcoholics Anonymous, the structure of the United States and Canada, around the world and around this country as well, too. And what an absolute privilege that is for a guy that was this close from taking his life, that couldn't stop drinking for 2 or 3 hours, for you, for the fellowship to have faith in me and to encourage me over the years and to love me back to health, and have the confidence in me to represent you around the world. And I have had the most incredible journey throughout that time. You know, my mother unfortunately picked up a drink about 7 years after she left meetings, and she died from alcoholism in December of 2012. And it was shortly after that I was elected to this service position, and what a miracle that was. You know, the day that I was elected, I was sitting in the chapel waiting to see if my delegate would call me to let me know what happened. And a woman that my mother used to sponsor had come into that chapel holding a big book with a woman following behind her who didn't look so good. And they kneeled down behind me and they did a third step prayer. I thought, wow. And I'm convinced that my mother was with me that day. My mother was at the General Service Conference that day. And I went into the hat with another member of AA following our third, what's called our third legacy procedure. If you read our service manual, you find out about that. That's how we elect people here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So there are two names in there, and I think my mother reached in there and pulled my name out of the hat and said, I want my boy to serve AA, you know. And it's been a privilege. In this capacity, as trustee at large, as I said, I represent AA in the United States Canadian structure around the world, and I'm an international delegate and serve at two World Services meetings over over a 4-year time frame, and two meetings of the Americas. They're called zonal meetings, rodelas, in South America. And I was in Warsaw, Poland, for my first World Service meeting, and there were four new countries that were accepted into the fold then: Iran, the Czech Republic, Hong Kong, and Romania. and AA was just barely coming up in some of those countries just a few years ago. And here they are at the World Service Meeting, and we come together and we share. We share how we carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in our individual countries. We're unified throughout the world on the way that we carry out this program. We help each other to try to reach out to find more alcoholics. There's so much work to do. I spent 2 weeks earlier this year in Russia on a four-week trip in different parts of the Baltic states. You know, they only have 400 groups in Russia. Do you know how many alcoholics there are in Russia and how much how much work there is to do there? I mean, wow, you know. But they are trying, and they are doing what they can to translate our literature. I love your seventh tradition practice that you have happening here. The dollars that you put in the basket make these things happen. You help translate this literature, you know. One of those countries, Iran, that came to the World Service Meeting, that delegate shared how, because of the Islamic State that it is in Iran, that they can't hold meetings within buildings. And if they get caught, you know what happens? That happens, you know. So they hold meetings outside in the cold or in the extreme hot, between 5 degrees above zero to 105 degrees above zero. And they do it. But they've translated the big book into Farsi, and they are flourishing. And AA is finding its way throughout Iran. In Russia, our big book is translated there as well. It's translated into 69 languages. There are 15 that are in process right now. And it's an absolute miracle. And that all happens because of your Seventh Tradition dollars. Seventh Tradition dollars really from around the world. But we all need to participate in this. To carry this message, it does cost money. Bill Wilson talked about that in some of his early writings, how when Ebby came to see him, he had to pay 10 cents to get on the train to come and carry that message, you know. And we all need to do that, so we need to remember that, you know. So, in any event, I am so grateful to be here with all of you. And, you know, I've had so many wonderful things happen to me. Serving in this role, all the other service roles I've had, my wife, my children, my home, my business, you know, a warm home in the winter and a cold climate, a cool home in the summer and a hot climate. We got everything in Massachusetts, that's for sure. And all of these things, though, these are the fruits of my sobriety, and they may not happen for you, but you have your own fruits of sobriety. But I always need to remember that I can never, ever, ever let what AA gave me get in the way of AA. And AA is always first. Life is busy doing all these things. I'm on the road probably roughly 26 times this year. And I have 6 children and run a business and a wife, that, like I've said. But we find a way. We live in the moment. It's a day at a time. It's busy. If you think you're too busy to serve AA, come talk to me after the meeting. But in any event, it's incumbent upon all of us to show up. Sometimes just being here is enough, week after week, and somebody can see your face and say, that person's here all the time and they seem happy, I'm attracted to that, and you might make them come back, you know. And we all need to be there. We all have an obligation and a duty to preserve and protect the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, to keep our message to our problems with alcohol, to discuss that within our groups and what that really means, to ask questions if we don't know what it means, to investigate our literature. We have hundreds of pamphlets and other pieces of literature that sometimes we don't avail ourselves to that can help us to reach out to the still sick and suffering alcoholic. It's so wonderful to see a big meeting with a pamphlet rack and people here and you're here week after week for the person that's probably just down the road in a gutter that may need you and to find you here someday. So anyway, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here with you tonight and speak with you, and God bless.